It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
On this vote, the yeas are 232, the nays are 183. The joint resolution is passed. Without objection, a motion to reconsider is laid on the table.
Today, the House of Representatives cleared a hurdle to make the Equal Rights Amendment the 28th amendment to the Constitution. The House voted to remove a deadline for states to ratify the amendment, which would guarantee women the same legal rights as men. Congress first sent the amendment to the states in 1972 and ultimately gave them 10 years to ratify it. It was quickly ratified by 35 states, but stopped short of the required 38 needed to make it a part of the Constitution. No other state joined for 40 years until Nevada took it up in 2017. Illinois ratified the ERA in 2018, and Virginia did it last month. That means the required 3/4 of states have ratified it, but now we are decades past the congressional deadline. So further complicating the matters, 5 states have since rescinded their initial ratification. So the resolution to remove the deadline now moves to the Senate.
And that's what happened yesterday morning when the House of Representatives voted to extend the deadline for the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment. It was interesting how they set up this vote. And just to remind you, this started back in the 1970s. Actually, started sooner than that. But it was supposed to be an amendment to the Constitution, which would allegedly set up equal rights for women. But of course, that's not really what the left has in mind. But the amendment itself says equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. And this is how they have set up females, women in this country, especially young women, to embrace the Equal Rights Amendment. Listen to Jackie Speer, who sponsored the resolution, and hear how she described it.
Our message here today is quite simple. We want in. We want in the Constitution of the United States of America. I stand here before you as an equal member of the Congress, equal to my male colleagues. We all are equal to our male colleagues in this building. But then when I walk out of this building and down those steps, I am no longer equal. Then every other woman in this room, including the third most powerful person in the country, is relegated to a second-class role. Because women are not recognized in our founding document, the Constitution, as fully equal to men under the law, we are not equal. Tomorrow's vote on HJ Res 79, my resolution to facilitate ratification of the ERA, is a vote for equality. It's a vote for justice. It's a vote for sisterhood and motherhood, survival, dignity, and respect. 97 years we've been trying to get this in the Constitution of the United States, starting with Alice Paul. It's a vote for the American dream, to be on the same footing as everyone else in order to pursue our great potential. It is a vote for America that we have fought so hard to become. It's a vote for that more perfect union. Our vote is also a strong message that women in America are done. We are done being harassed, assaulted, and violated with impunity. We are done being paid less for the same work. We are done being discriminated against for our pregnancies. We are done being disparaged and demeaned by those who work daily to undermine the rights we have secured, including those who hold the highest office in the land. From the Women's March to the Me Too movement to the Pink Wave, our march continues today with the Equal Rights Amendment. Delays and distractions will not slow our progress because there can be no expiration date on equality.
And so the congresswoman from New York has to say, or from California had to say, and you know, this whole thing is just a smoke and mirrors. They want to paint this in a way that says, and they have done this for years, that women are so mistreated. Women are not equal under the law, and they have all of these problems. Well, now, when ERA was first discussed back, I think, in 1920, I think there was some legitimacy to that. But the clever crafters of this amendment had something far greater in mind. And I've talked about this before, but I want to say again, this was not about being equal. Women are equal, for heaven's sake. Men, male and female, are equal. I mean, it's certainly that's a scriptural principle. Male and female created he them. In Christ, there's neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female. There is no distinction from God's perspective. There's a distinction in treatment and equality. There is a distinction, though. They're not the same. They are not the same. Males and females are not the same. The people that are pushing this whole concept want to eradicate any differences between male and female. I have to confess to you that when Phyllis Schlafly first started speaking about this, I didn't quite comprehend. But, you know, the last decades have sort of brought us to a different place where we now know openly there is an attempt to erase differences between male and female. And how dangerous that is. This has wider repercussions by erasing the differences in the legal code. This would be an amendment to the Constitution. And so this is not just about women. Don't even think that it is. And certainly it seems absurd to me for them to claim that in this year, 2020, in the United States of America, that women are not equal. I'm sorry, I don't see that. And even the equal pay for equal work nonsense is just not true. And it hasn't been true for decades, and I could talk about that, but I won't get in a sidebar. I don't know what's going to happen next. The one thing that they're not talking about, 38 states were supposed to ratify. That was the constitutional goal in order for it to be an amendment. They didn't get that until just this past year. I think Nevada, and certainly last was Virginia. But what they don't mention is that in the interim of this many years, five states have withdrawn. So they're not willing to, you know, talk about the ones that rescinded their participation in this. They only want to count the ones that have passed it. So it's a bit lawless in the House. It has been for a while, and we're just seeing more signs of that. I find it really interesting that there's another sidebar to this that I think is worth talking about, and that's, you know, Chief Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg she was all part of that movement. She is a radical feminist. She was an attorney for the ACLU. This is her bailiwick. And in a conversation, I believe at Georgetown, just in this past week or two, she spoke about the ERA as she was speaking. And this is what Jonathan Turley, who's also a law professor, he's not a Supreme Court justice, but he's a highly esteemed law professor who is not a conservative, but he's actually very honest. And he says this: Ginsburg actually trips the wire on both issues in discussing a matter in litigation and making a political statement that she would like to see a new effort to pass the ERA. While this thrills liberals, would the contrary views be so welcomed in a sitting justice? And actually, then Jonathan went on to pen a very interesting article, which is called, it's titled, "A Judge Would Be Disqualified. Justice Ginsburg Again Wades into Political Controversies" in an interview. And he's critiquing what she said because it's public knowledge. And so this is what Jonathan says: "While not unique on the court, Ginsburg has repeatedly crossed the line of traditional public speaking in discussing political controversies, pending issues before the court, and even criticizing the president. Despite repeated controversies and speaking publicly on political issues, Ginsburg remains undeterred." And I want to just point out, you may or may not realize that when even local judges are elected, I have a good friend that sits in a court, a high court, and I've known him since he was just graduated from law school, but I remember one of our conversations, he said one of the hardest things for him as a judge is that he can no longer speak of his opinions publicly, can't talk about his political views, can't talk about how he feels about anything because it's just not done. So keep that in mind. And she's a Supreme Court justice. So Jonathan Hurley goes on to say, earlier this year, Ginsburg again repeated her view that sexist voters prevented Hillary Clinton from being elected president, which is a repeat of controversial comments she first made in 2017. This week, Ginsburg commented on the merits of President Donald Trump's call for a review of the Supreme Court, and even criticized senators who have made public statements about the impeachment. Indeed, the most ironic part of her commentary was Ginsburg noting how inappropriate it is for senators to be discussing their views of the merits before any actual impeachment. She insisted, quote, if a judge said that, a judge would be disqualified from sitting on the case, end quote. Turley, that raises a rather uncomfortable question as to what Ginsburg was doing in that very interview. In discussing these issues with the BBC's Razia Iqbal, Ginsburg commented on Trump's desire for a review of the basis for impeachment. She dismissed the idea, noted that, quote, the president is not a lawyer. He's not law trained, end quote. Turley, the court just took a case with potential bearing on the impeachment and particularly the article of obstruction of Congress. For Ginsburg to make any comments on this issue is wildly inappropriate. She then added criticism of Majority Leader Mitch McConnell for discussing his views, and she said, well, if a judge said that, a judge would be disqualified from sitting on the case. Some of us have raised concerns over such comments, but we are not members of the Supreme Court. Ginsburg, even still, was not done. She turned to abortion and declared, quote, I think society needs to be more active on this issue. And the truth is that with all these restrictive laws, the only people who are being restricted are poor women. They normally can't pay a plane fare for the or a bus fare. They can't afford to take a day off of work to go, end quote. Hurley, that is not just direct commentary on political and legal issues, but a direction to what people should be doing on a political issue. It is facially inappropriate, and the media would not be so silent if another justice like Samuel Alito was advising pro-life forces on what they needed to do. And then it goes on to say it was ironic. It was an ironic moment for a justice who is credited with what's known as the Ginsburg Rule, where, during her confirmation, she refused to answer questions that might be raised in cases before her. It's widely quoted all the time, the Ginsburg Rule, you don't talk about things you might have to decide if you're confirmed as a justice. But after being confirmed, Ginsburg regularly discussed the issues that she declined to discuss in the confirmation. So I just think that's another part of this. She's weighed in on the Equal Rights Amendment. She's all about it, wants to have a new effort for it. And she is not supposed to be speaking about that, but she's bulletproof. She's RBG, by the way, and she's been memorialized in all of these movies, and they've made her into some sort of a pop star. And I think Jonathan Hurley is correct. This but is correct. It is very dangerous. By the way, that Created Equal movie is that beautiful movie about Justice Clarence Thomas's life, which I challenge any of you who love the notorious RGB, RBG. I loved the movies about her. I saw two of them. I challenge you to go see this movie about Clarence Thomas's life. It is so compelling. It's lovely. So that's what happened yesterday morning. And coming up next, we're going to be talking about something completely different. There is a move afoot in the same Congress to pass a labor law that is kind of like the Green New Deal. To what the Green New Deal is to the environment is what this law is to labor. It's another nightmare on the horizon, and you will want to know about it. So stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Well, even before that envelope got opened, just being in the presence, in the company of our sister and brother documentarians, who risked their lives making stories, bringing stories to us about hospitals being bombed in Syria, about Brazil, about Macedonia. We were so proud. We are inspired by you guys. Our film is from Ohio and China. Go Buckeyes! But it really could be from anywhere that people put on a uniform, a punch clock, trying to make their families have a better life. Working people have it harder and harder these days. And we believe that things will get better when workers of the world unite.
That was the voice of documentary filmmaker Julia Reichardt at the Oscars earlier this week as she accepted an award for her movie, her and her husband's movie called American Factory. And by the way, it's the first picture to come from Higher Ground Productions, which is the production company owned by Barack and Michelle Obama. Now, Julia Reichardt, you know, go Buckeyes, Julia Reichardt, at the end of her speech said, "Workers of the world unite." Now, some of you may know and some of you might not know that that's actually part of the Communist Manifesto. That was Karl Marx's marching orders at the end of his manifesto. And so this Buckeye from Ohio with her film produced by Higher Ground, run by Barack and Michelle, reminds all Americans through the movie and through the Oscar audience that workers of the world should unite. I wonder what we are to think. Well, we're going to talk about that and a lot more with our next guest. Mike Watson is the research director of Capital Research Center. He's also the managing editor of Influence Watch, which is a powerful part of their website that follows the money and the influence of the left on this culture. Mike, thanks for joining us this morning.
Oh, thanks for having me, Sandy.
All right, before we get into the nuts and bolts of what we're going to talk about today, I wonder what your comments might be on that documentary and on her statement.
Well, I can't say much about the documentary because I haven't watched it. But as for the statement, I do find it somewhat ironic that she's quoting the Communist Manifesto, accepting an award for a film that is at least in some ways about the relations between American factory workers and the Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, it is. It is very strange. Okay, so, and that kind of sets the stage for our discussion, Mike, because labor unions have been kind of a part of American DNA. And I have to say that most of us, not all of us, but a lot of us, half of us at least, came up from working families, in the traditional use of that word, where our parents worked hard. Some of them worked physically, others worked in other ways. But we know what the term worker means in our tradition. And we have had unions for a long time, and they've been controversial. There are unions for factories, as in that documentary. There are unions for, coal miners. There are unions for teachers and others. There are police unions now and fire unions. But I want to talk to you, Mike, before we get into the real issue at hand here and what's happening now. I know you're an expert at this, and it makes me go back in time and wonder where was the birth of unions? When did unions start? I'm guessing Europe. Do you know?
Well, I can say in the United States, it's in the sort of late 1800s. There's the Industrial Revolution in the early 1800s, but by the late 1800s, there is discontent within what is often called the working class, but the sort of the factory, industrial, shop floor guys. And it's mostly guys at this point, although there were some women involved. And thanks to some theories of social organization from Europe, especially Germany, there's organizing, there's sort of a legal question, should unions be legal? A lot of early violence on both sides, both by management representatives and by labor unions, these sort of proto-labor unions. And it's not until the 1930s as part of the New Deal that FDR and his allies sort of codify what we understand as labor unions in the United States.
I would think we have to be clear that certainly in our history of this country, there are certainly documented evidence that the robber barons are the guys that were getting really very wealthy in the 1800s and as America became stronger. Not all of them, but many of them did take advantage of their workers. It's always been kind of human nature. There are greedy rich people and there are greedy poor people.
Yeah, so, that was certainly the sentiment that encouraged some of the early labor organizing, yes.
Yeah, and I also want to say, Mike, that certainly labor unions were very powerful in Europe. I remember reading the biography of Mao Zedong, and he actually, before he started his Chinese Revolution, spent a lot of time with the European communists. And one of the things they instructed him to do, of course, the general message was to cause disruption, to divide people, to turn people against each other. There was a lot more to it than that. Agitate, you know, cause trouble, and then come in as though you have the solution, and whether it's a natural disaster. Yeah, so anyway, so he modeled that when he went back to China, and that's how he took power. So
One thing I would caution, American trade unionism, at least before about 1990, was in many ways set up as trying to be a middle way between the sort of outright socialism, obviously the state socialism of the Eastern Bloc, and even the social democracy of Germany or of the you know, Clement Attlee Labor Party, and the sort of what is called unrestricted capitalism of the American robber baron era. Samuel Gompers, the famed longtime president of the AFL, was very adamant that he was going to do collective bargaining for his members, that he was not going to do not going to work through the state. Now, that obviously changed, and it starts changing in the 30s, and by the 1990s, labor unions themselves, who is in a labor union, has changed to the degree that you end up with John Sweeney, who is widely suspected to have been a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, becomes president of the AFL-CIO.
Yeah, so it has an interesting mix, Mike, doesn't it? I mean, my perspective, and you're an expert on this, I'm not. But my perspective is that, you know, there were good reasons for people to bond together and, you know, work together to get fair wages and protections, like in coal mines and other places. There was a good reason to do that. But somehow, there was a decaying effect when the mob got involved. And now when the left got involved. And I don't know the distinction between those. Do you? Like, which came first, the chicken or the egg?
I mean, you always had left, progressive, social democratic, socialist ideology within the labor movement. The Congress of Industrial Organizations, which was the sort of militant, strongly left-wing arm of the labor movement in the 30s and 40s, was strongly infiltrated by Soviet communists. And this was a major controversy in the passage of the Taft-Hartley Act, because the Taft-Hartley Act prohibited communists from holding union office. And the unions debated, should we accept this? And in fact, it's the social democratic leader of the UAW, Walter Reuther, who says, you know, more or less, yes, we should. And that runs the communists out of the CIO, and then the CIO and the AFL get back together. As for the mob, the mafia influence mostly comes because of how unions operate. Unions are a cartel. You know, they control the supply of workers to employers, and they can cut that supply off if the employers don't do what the union wants. And if the union is run honestly, that can be used for, you know, the at least short-run benefit of the members. If the union is run dishonestly by Jimmy Hoffa, that can be used for the benefit of Jimmy Hoffa.
Yes, which is what happened in so many cases. And you describe, you've written several articles about this, Mike, which I've written, which I've read. And you talk about the history of unions, and you talk about a not-so-good time right after World War II, when really things hit rock bottom with union relationships. Can you describe that?
Yeah, so during World War II, there were agreements between labor, business, and the government, basically to keep the factories open, to keep some degree of profit to the companies that were building all this war material, and to preserve what is called labor peace, meaning not strikes, to keep the war material coming out and to keep the soldiers and sailors and airmen equipped and ready to go, you know, fight the Germans and fight the Japanese. Then the war ends. And the unions realize that all these soldiers, sailors, and airmen are now coming back. They're going to be reintegrated into the workforce. That's going to put a strain on their cartel. And also, the demand for the military, all this military production, is now going to stop because we don't need any more B-17s. And the unions respond by basically releasing all their pent-up frustration with there were wage controls during the war to prevent inflation, and the unions respond by going on a massive strike wave. Over a million people go on strike. The biggest strike was, the representative strike was in the car industry against GM. It's Walter Reuther's UAW against GM. And what Reuther does is, you know, we're used to the union making the demand. We want higher wages. We want maybe shorter hours or more predictable hours or more overtime or whatever. Reuther goes beyond that. Not only does he want a massive wage increase, he also wants to have a say in setting the sale price of cars. And this is utterly unacceptable to GM, because that would be giving the unions control over GM's business practices. And so they strike for, I believe it was over 100 days. Ultimately, because the steel strike, there's a simultaneous steel strike, the steel strike ends, and basically GM comes and says, you get the same terms that the steel companies gave the steel workers, and the UAW gives in. So they get a wage increase, not as much as they asked for, and they don't get a say over the car making.
And then Congress got involved, as I understand it, Mike, and had to sort of make a course correction with the Taft-Hartley Act. And you say in your article that that actually caused a boon in the economy. They got signed up. Because what you didn't say, you hinted at it, but one of the requests of the United Auto Workers was a 30% pay hike, then a control of the prices on the cars. So it would have been debilitating to the country and to the industry.
Well, it was. 45-46 was a recessionary period. And that resulted in the New Deal Democrats being voted out of office to a degree in the House of Representatives that the Republicans have not matched that high water mark other than I think maybe once. And as a result, over Truman's veto, although there is some dispute as to what Truman actually thought of the law, over Truman's veto, Congress, bipartisan supermajorities, pass the Taft-Hartley Act, which, among other things, allows right-to-work laws, prohibits the secondary strike. You can only strike against an employer that you have a live dispute. Bars communists from union office, has a number of other provisions that are rebalancing labor relations after the 1930s, which had given the unions what turned out to be far too much power.
So fast forward, really fast forward to now. And what we want to talk about, what we certainly want to talk about in this conversation, and we're going to come back and we'll pick up a couple of those other decades, but there is a bill that was just passed in the House called the PRO Act. It's H.R. 2474. And fair to say, wouldn't you think, Mike, that labor unions have lost a lot of their grip because of right-to-work laws and other things? I think of whatever the law was that stopped people from being coerced into joining unions caused quite a dent in their membership. And now the PRO Act is an attempt to sort of reinstate the power of the unions. When we return, Mike Watson again is my guest. He's the research director of Capital Research Center and managing editor of what's known as Influence Watch, which I can't say enough about. We don't mention it often enough, but Influence Watch is a place you'd want to go for a nice light evening reading to find out, you know, who's really pulling the strings in this country. But Mike will be back with me in a second. And we want to talk about what the Democrats have in mind with this PRO Act. Think of, you know, the Green New Deal as it applies to labor. and management decisions, which affects each and every one of us. So you need to hear about this, so stay tuned. This is Sandy Rios in the Morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Frank Shearer. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, you said that.
Under the contract, management can only fire a driver on very specific charges. So, do you ever show up late?
No.
Do you have any moving violations?
No.
Do you drink on the job?
No.
You ever hit anybody?
On a job?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
All right, then. We don't have nothing to worry about.
All right, that's the beginning of the trailer of this new movie called, well, it's not so new now, The Irishman. It's a Martin Scorsese film, and in part talks about Jimmy Hoffa, the head of the Teamsters Union. I'm not recommending the movie because I didn't see it because I know it's pretty violent and crass, but just case in point, it was about the history of unions, a certain part of our history with unions. And so that's what we're talking about today. Are they good or are they bad? And what is the left doing in regard to labor unions? Actually, some pretty big stuff that you need to know about. Mike Watson is my guest from Capital Research Center. Michael's done a number of stories. By the way, we'll put two of them on our Facebook page. Because they will talk about this PRO Act that we're going to discuss today. Mike, leading up to this act that we're going to discuss, the labor unions have receded in their power and influence. Why do you think that is, in more detail than what I just said?
You've had fundamental structural changes in the economy that have caused the old industrial shop floor model of organizing a workplace to not be as meaningful. We've seen a shift towards service work, more in these sort of professional services from manufacturing, and where we've had manufacturing growth, a lot of it has been in the less unionized right to work states, where employers and employees can come to more flexible arrangements, and where the general cost of living has been lower.
So places like let's paint though for a second before we talk about this act. One of the things, you know, because I've covered education a lot, the unions, the education unions, are of keen interest to me, and I've probably followed them more closely than the others. People were being forced to pay dues to support political causes that they did not believe in. And there was some legislation passed. Please help me. What was,
it was
that?
It was a Supreme Court decision. One of the key divisions in labor is between the government workers, state and local government workers, and the private sector. And so your public school teachers are government workers. And what the Supreme Court ruled in a case called Janus v. AFSCME was that any money paid for any reason to a government worker labor union affected public policy, and that meant that the employee had a free speech right not to pay that money. And so in the 23 states that that do not have a right to work law, that meant that those government employees, those public school teachers, were having their constitutional rights violated. And so what that Supreme Court case meant was that they no longer had to pay those fees if they didn't want to be members of the union, if they didn't want to support the union's advocacy agenda.
Okay, so that made a big dent in the numbers, not just in teachers' unions, but other unions. And of course, right-to-work laws have changed a lot of things, too, not forcing people to join unions in the 27 states then that have those laws. All right, so here comes the PRO Act, H.R. 2474, which was passed in Congress just last week, right?
Yes.
All right. Well, they were busy. Interesting. I didn't know they had time to pass bills, but they found time to pass this one. Okay, so talk to us about this, Mike. You call it a parade of horribles, so let's hear it. What is the parade of horribles?
So the first thing is that for all the private sector workers in the states that have right-to-work laws, those right-to-work laws go away. Unions have wanted them to go away ever since they existed, so this law would get rid of them. Then you have, I mentioned earlier, secondary boycotts. Right now, if you're GM and you have unionized workers, the unionized workers can only strike against GM if they have a problem with GM, not if they have a problem with the supplier, if they have a problem with, some political cause. Other things that are wrong with it, the Obama administration National Labor Relations Board, which is the sort of the weird judging system for labor cases, passed a number of rules, what sound like very technical rules, joint employment, basically regarding franchises and whether the name on the door is also responsible for the local franchisors, the local franchisees' labor practices. There was a decision by the Obama Labor Board that the PRO Act would codify that says that if your workplace is having a union campaign, the union organizer gets your personal contact information, whatever personal contact information the employer has. So it's a number and then probably one of the things, you may remember from several years ago, card check to get rid of the secret ballot.
Yes, I was just, that actually was just in my mind just now. I didn't remember the name, where people have to vote whether to unionize or not publicly, raise their hand so everyone can see where they stand on it. And then there's retribution.
The PRO Act, they tried to be a little bit sneaky in that technically you still have a secret ballot vote. But if the employer cannot prove to the satisfaction of those labor judges, the National Labor Relations Board, that he committed no errors, the labor board can just set it aside and just say say that the public cards are enough and you're unionized.
So just to be clear, Mike, this, as I recall, this means like small business owners. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the limitation, but I remembered it was small business owners. The union could just come in and have your employees decide right there without for all the details you just described, not really having privacy about how they vote on whether to unionize or not. What was the size? Do you remember? I'm sorry, I'm asking you all these questions.
I do not know.
Okay.
And again, the way it would be under the PRO Act is, the employees would get one man, one vote, one time, but it would only count if the union won. Essentially, it would only count if the union won.
Wow. Okay, so let's get a little bit, we're doing kind of union speak, so let's make it really clear. You talked about that secondary targeting, but give us an example of what you mean by that.
It's easiest to discuss it sort of outside of the labor case. Because there are a lot of really technical rules, but just as a concept, think about with Second Amendment when the anti-gun people protest the bank that lends money to the NRA. Their target isn't really that bank. They're not trying to change that bank's business practices. They're trying to They're trying to punish the NRA. So in a labor case of that. You know, if you're trying to unionize let's say Volkswagen, and there is a supplier, and you picketed the supplier so that the supplier wouldn't supply to Volkswagen until Volkswagen unionized.
Okay.
That loosely would be a secondary boycott.
Well, we're seeing that already with, you actually point this out, and I'm very familiar with this part, where Media Matters is boycotting. This is the same concept. I'm sure
It's the same concept. If you're not a labor union, you can do a secondary boycott. But labor unions get a bunch of other a bunch of other privileges. They can, if even in a right to work state, if you don't want to be a member of the union, if your workplace is unionized, you still are judged by the union contract. You know, if you're in a non-right to work state, the union can force you to pay them. Again, unless you're a government worker. So unions get a bunch of privileges, and one of the costs that they have to pay under current law for those privileges is no secondary boycotts.
Okay, and so just to complete my thought on that, because it was your thought, actually, the illustration would be like Media Matters going after, let's say, Rush Limbaugh and targeting his sponsors, who are innocent.
Yes.
They haven't gone on radio and said the things he said, but punishing them economically until they drop their advertising for Rush or Sean Hannity,
yes,
or whoever. That's a secondary boycott. That's a metaphor for one, even though it's not labor union related. And you say unions can... they cannot under the PRO Act. They want that to be reinstated. Their ability to do that
under the PRO Act. They want that to be reinstated. Yes.
Okay. Tell us, kind of give us an idea, because you do Influence Watch. How much influence, to the point, do American labor unions have on public policy and politicians?
A great deal is the short answer. You know, they are. The union political committees are massive supporters of the Democratic Party. The Open Secrets federal records show that over 90% of unions' federal political contributions go to Democrats and liberals. What's probably less well known is that unions are big supporters of all the institutional liberal organizations, the think tanks and issue groups. You mentioned Media Matters. Historically, I believe they have given Media Matters has taken some union funding, although not terribly recently. But it's important to know that unions don't just push for economic leftism, economic progressivism, higher minimum wages, government mandated labor conditions, higher taxes and spending. They're also major supporters of social liberal groups and social liberal causes, even that don't seem to have a labor nexus. Great example, the SEIU filed its own or joined with other liberal groups amicus briefs opposing the Hobby Lobby in the Obamacare contraceptive mandate case, and supporting the state of Colorado's efforts to force Jack Phillips to bake the cake for a same-sex wedding, which he had moral objections to.
Well, and also the National Education Association, which I'm more familiar with, is the largest labor union, has the largest lobbying group in Washington, D.C. You would know better than I.
But I know they are the largest labor union. I don't know about their size as a lobbying organization.
And in that capacity, they certainly lobby for things that have nothing to do with education. They spend their money, you know, pro-abortion, all things LGBT, for sure. I think that's their number one thing on their list in terms of their dollars spent. So this PRO Act, correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, is it's the dream list for the left to beef up labor unions, which then comes the supply chain of money comes back to them and their friendly organizations. It's to beef them up and make it possible for them to wield more power than they do at this current juncture, correct?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, so it's passed in the House. Where is it now and what's going to happen?
So it's now sitting before the Senate. Obviously, that is not auspicious for its prospects of passage in this current Congress. If it were somehow to pass the Senate, which is unlikely, I believe the president has issued a veto threat. But we have to look at a bill, you have to look at a bill like this as a declaration of intention. Even though they know that it's not going to become law particularly soon, it's a way for politicians to get their messaging out and to say, you know, we're strong supporters of unions. We are going to do everything the unions want. It's a signal to unions to support certain politicians, which Richard Trumka, who's the president of the AFL-CIO, the largest federation of labor unions, basically issued put out a tweet saying, you know, if you have our back, we'll have yours. So it's a signal to them, and that's kind of what this is about. But it's something that people need to be aware of.
Yes, absolutely. And let me put it this way. Just as the Green New Deal will become policy, that nightmare of a proposition will become policy if the left takes over this country, as will their policy on illegal immigration, which means open borders, paying for all the health care of illegal immigrants. The PRO Act is to labor what those bills are to those different topics, and there are others as well. But you need to be aware, this is what's going to happen. If they take control of the House and the Senate, and if they win back the presidency, this is going to be the future of our country. The forces are amassing, and so this is just a warning. It's called the PRO Act. Mike Watson, Research Director of Capital Research Center. Mike, thank you so much. We appreciate your time and all your hard work. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.